Good morning.
Good morning.
Does that sound seem acceptable to everyone? If you saw the announcement for this retreat on Eventbrite or on our excuse me, on our website, then you saw that I entitled the retreat "A Good Voyage of Nothing." I didn't make up that phrase. In fact, William Shakespeare made up that phrase. And it's from his play called The Twelfth Night. And it comes in a scene where two characters are saying, "So long, see you later." Of course, in much more eloquent, refined language. And the actual language is, it's actually, if you know the play, it's the Duke and the clown are departing. And the Duke says, "Give me now leave to leave thee." And the clown says, "And now the melancholy god protect thee, and the tailor make thy doublet of changeable taffeta. For thy mind is a very opal. I would have men of such constancy put to sea, that their business might be everything, and their intent everywhere. For that's it that always makes a good voyage of nothing." So, when I saw this play recently, and when the clown who was playing those lines gave those lines, he went like this to the audience. Yeah. So there's a lot to, you know, it's a rather koan-like statement there, you know. It's a rather, there's a lot to unpack, and it's not totally clear what the clown was getting at, I don't think. Or at least not immediately. But when I heard the line, "A Good Voyage of Nothing," it leaped out at me, and I thought, well, that's like something you would say to somebody going on a retreat, you know, leaving for a long retreat. "May you have, you know, a good voyage of nothing." That would be from our perspective a kind wish for someone to have a retreat that was not crowded with many arisings, and where one could leave behind everyday affairs for a time and devote themselves to our sitting practice, which at bottom is a good voyage of nothing. So I gave a talk last month at SBMG, which one person here heard, but I'm going to say a little bit of what I repeat a little bit of what I said at that talk, and it was that I recounted for some people that were there something about my own good voyage of nothing, which I'm marking a kind of milestone this year, because it was this milestone occurred 40 years ago, at that time I decided to make a test run to live near the San Francisco Zen Center, Karen and I were living in Eugene, Oregon, and had been practicing at the Zen Center long distance for a few years. And so in 1980, in the winter of 1980, I decided to make a test run to San Francisco, and I got a room across the street from San Francisco Zen Center. And I also enrolled at what was then called the, I think it was California Institute of Asian Studies. California Institute of Asian Studies. And I took classes there, and I went to the Zendo right across the street for, I don't know, it was like a quarter worth of education. So I was there till March or something. And subsequent to that test run, I went back to Eugene, and we talked a lot about what to do, and ultimately decided that I would sell my little gardening business that I had, and that we would move to San Francisco. And so in the fall of that year, 1980, we did that. We moved to San Francisco. We were lucky to find an apartment on Guerrero Street, and we started riding our bikes down Guerrero Street to San Francisco Zen Center every morning at, I don't know, pretty early. Yeah, pretty early in the morning, like 4 o'clock or 4:30. Yeah, we had to leave, I think, by at least 4:30 to make the ride. And there's some hills there too, you know. And within a few months, anyway, we were found ourselves totally involved. We were both working for Zen Center within a few months, and we were totally immersed in the community, and we had entered the community. So one thing that happened to me early on in my time there at Zen Center was one day I was walking in the corridor of the we never lived in the building. We always lived like in an apartment, you know, near where we could go easily to Zazen in the morning. But one day I was walking in the residential floor of the building, and somebody had put up a cartoon on their door, and it was a Graham Wilson cartoon, and it showed two monks sitting on the ton, you know, the sitting platform, and one monk leans over to the other and whispers, "Nothing happens next." So that cartoon has stuck with me all these years, and I don't know if when I saw that cartoon, I don't think I fully got the double entendre, or maybe triple entendre of that cartoon at that time. Maybe I thought, well, that sounds discouraging or something like that. I don't think at that time I thought, you know, that monk is bragging. That monk thinks he's an adept. And maybe, I mean, I don't know if Graham Wilson even thought that when he was making the cartoon, but that's kind of how I see the double entendre in any way. So, last night, or it's not last night, but last Monday, Myo was here, and after his visit that night, I had a dream, and I dreamed about a garage that was full of stuff, full of detritus, and things, full to the rafters. And I was having a garage sale, and I wanted to get rid of the stuff in the garage sale. And the interesting thing was, then I later thought about it, I thought that actually when we lived in Eugene, there was a garage where we lived, and it was full of stuff. And but it wasn't our stuff, it was somebody else's stuff, and we never went in there. But I was wondering, I wondered later, was it that garage that I was dreaming about 40 years later? I don't know. But anyway, this garage was full of stuff, and I was having a sale, and some people were coming over to, you know, take the stuff, but nobody would take anything. For whatever reason, nobody wanted anything, and I couldn't get rid of any of the thing. I had a completely, you know, failed garage sale. Couldn't get rid of any of the clutter. So this got me to thinking after the dream, and I thought, well, we don't know, you know, who wrote the Heart Sutra. We could say that it was written by somebody who had a very successful garage sale. They were able to get rid of all the clutter. And in fact, the Heart Sutra tells us that not only was all the clutter got rid of, but also the owner of the garage was got rid of. In fact, that was the most important thing. No eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind. No, all garage, very clean and emptied out. You know, sometimes there's some Zen stories that say it's like a vast empty room. A vast empty room. So this is kind of the direction, you know. This is kind of direction for us of our, you know, effort in Zazen. Cleaning out the clutter, or, you know, letting go of the clutter, or maybe sitting with a great aspiration that Buddha will come along to our garage sale and he will take everything, you know. Please, you know, give. Buddha will come to our garage sale and we'll be able to, you know, give that away. We'll be able to give away all the clutter. So, you know, we can sit with that kind of faith, you know. We can sit with that kind of faith that Buddha will come along and free us from all of the accumulated detritus, all of our ancient karma, all of our distraction, and let us sit empty and free. I think it's okay to have that aspiration or wish for Buddha to come along and help us in that way. The Sanskrit word for empty is shunya. And the Sanskrit word for emptiness is shunyata. Shunyata. When you add ta to a Sanskrit word, it always gives that ness, that, that nest meaning, emptiness, shunyata. Shunya, so shunya means emptiness, or translates as emptiness, and as empty, and shunyata translates as emptiness. And the word shunya also means zero. It also means the number zero. So zero is the number that gives all other numbers meaning. No numbers would have any meaning if it weren't for zero. All numbers are given their meaning in reference to zero. When we measure something or weigh something, it's always in reference to zero. Our lives are in reference to zero. That is the still point, the zero point of our lives. And we are so refreshed by returning to that zero point on the scale. So refreshed by that. So helpful to us, to our spirit, to return to that point. To whether we can absolutely return to zero, I don't know. But I am very sure that we can make an effort in that direction. We can make effort in the direction of that ultimate reference point. And I'm also very sure that when we make that kind of effort and we point ourselves in that direction, it's very refreshing, very helpful. Lightens our spirit, makes things more easeful, helps us be friendlier, helps us absorb. Shakespeare's coming to mind again. The slings of an arrow is of outrageous fortune. Helps us absorb the slings and arrows that inevitably, you know, do come our way. I quoted one part of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind in that announcement, and here's another part of that same chapter. Suzuki Roshi says, "So it is absolutely necessary for everyone to believe in nothing. But I do not mean voidness. There is something, but that something is something which is always prepared for taking some particular form, and it has some rules or theory or truth in its activity. This is called Buddha nature or Buddha himself." It's very difficult to talk about something that is only, you know, just the way language is. If you try to talk about nothing, you call it something. You know, it's hard not to call it something. It is very hard for us to really, you know, it's hard. Maybe the most skillful teachers can do it, but I think we can point at it maybe, but it's hard to talk about an absence, something that there's like, I mean, you can make analogy like, It's like an empty room. It's like vast space. Something like that. And many stories that we have talk about it that way. And maybe because it's hard to talk about, it's also hard to think that we're experiencing. It's hard for us to stay at the zero point on the scale. You know, the way we're built, we're built for a kind of elaboration. You know, for some expression and some complication to arise. It just seems like that's the way we're built. You know, we crave it, or we have a very strong, you know, we have will. You know, we have volition, and this is, you know, in Buddhism, this is closely related to how we create karma, right? We create karma through volition, called chetana. Volition is, or will is, chetana, and it's, you know, it's closely associated with karma, how we create karma. And so we have a really strong tendency to, you know, elaborate and create, you know, to do action, to think, to elaborate in various ways. So it's it takes quite a bit of training and quite a bit of concentrated effort to give that up, to let go of that, to return back to this sort of ultimate reference point. But I think it does help to remember that zero is the ultimate reference point. Nothing, no number, no weight, no measure has any meaning without zero. So I think we Suzuki Roshi is saying, you know, he thinks it's very important that we believe, you know, he says at the outset of that chapter something like, I have come to, you know, believe or I have come to feel that it is very important that we should believe in nothing. That if we're going to have a belief, we should ground ourselves in the absolute zero. Yeah, but the ground of being, emptiness. In that line that I quoted from the 12th night, it has there at the end, it says, I would have men of such constancy put to sea that their business might be everything and their intent everywhere, for that's it that always makes a good voyage of nothing. Every direction, all voyages are given meaning by their reference to zero, to their fidelity to the ground of being, to emptiness. In our sitting practice, we, you know, confirm this. This is the direction of our sitting practice, to confirm this and express our fidelity to that, to that belief, our fidelity to that belief. And that kind of fidelity or faith, you know, believing, faith, we can express that in our sitting practice by every time that we find ourselves off on a train of thought, off in some direction, everywhere, all the directions that we take. We express our fidelity by coming back, by returning to just this awareness, you know, just this bright awareness. Last night I was reading something in Reb Anderson's book, Turning the Third Turning of the Wheel, the Third Turning of the Wheel. And he talks about, there's a wonderful chapter in there which I would highly recommend everybody read about 10 times on shamatha and vipassana. And it's a difficult chapter because that book is about the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, which is a difficult, very difficult text. Reb, I think, maybe the only commentator, you know, in English that's ever attempted to write a commentary on it. Yeah.
What's the English name of that sutra? The Flower Garden?
Oh, no, no. No, the English name.
That's the Cleary book, right? Is the translation of it.
Well, the John Powers, there's like three different.
Wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. The what does Cleary call his book? Yeah, he calls his book Buddhist Yoga. That is not a direct translation, however, of that text.
Oh, that's not the Sandhi Nirmochana which is formed from the Yogacara. Isn't that what that book is?
That book is a yoga, you know, kind of the basis almost of Yogacara teaching, you know, mind-only teaching. That sutra, excuse me, is a fundamental. Anyway, we're getting off on the point I was trying to make, which is the point. I don't know what the I can't remember what the translation is. That's the answer to your question, The point that I was meeting that I read last night, that I've read many times before, and I still have a hard time remembering it, but it's something like attend to the essentially this is a paraphrase of it, attend to the stream of meditating consciousness, attend to the stream of meditating consciousness with continuous mental attention. Attend to the stream of your meditation with continuous mental attention. So it's like this is sort of like, you know, we usually just talk about, you know, attend to what's arising, right? And this is sort of like piling it on in a certain way, or attend to the first of all, it just implies that you can sort of in your sitting you feel that you have reached this ground of being, you have reached the stream of meditating consciousness. And now you've reached that stream, you continually swim in it. You keep swimming in it. You jump in, you find it. You know, it's like you're walking through the forest. Where's the stream? And that's kind of like what our meditation is like, right? We're sitting and many thoughts are arising and once in a while remember, oh yeah, I'm meditating. So then we remember that we're looking for the stream of meditative consciousness, right? We're looking for the stream of concentration. It's somewhere around here, and we're looking for it. And then, so this teaching in the Samdhi Nirmocana Sutra is that now you've found the stream. Now pay attention to it with continuous meditative attention. So this is like, you know, you could say almost like a two-step process or something. You know, first find the stream, and Reb talks about, you know, unwavering attention in that stream. So you're not getting out of the stream in this vision of samadhi. You know, you enter this stream and you stay in it, swimming right with it, you know, right with the current. It's kind of like that image, you know. Don't swim faster than the current. Don't swim slower than the current. Swim right with the current, you know. And it's a good analogy. Don't get stuck in the eddies, you know. In the eddies, they swirl around and they go back upstream. And, you're not staying in the continuous flow of meditative concentration. So, and I would submit that when you can make that kind of effort, you know, that kind of effort can be talked about, you know, as an effort in the direction of zero, or directed in the direction of emptiness, because there's just nothing else. There's nothing else there but the stream, and there's actually, you know, as Dzogchen Rinpoche likes to say, there's no you there. There's no you to say I in that stream. There's no you there. There's just a stream. There's just swimming in it. You know, there's no separation then between you and the stream. And I don't mean to talk about, like, here's this ideal state, now you folks all go reach it, you know. That's not a good way to talk, but I don't want you to hear it that way. I'm saying this is what some adepts are reporting, you know, is what they're doing on their meditation cushion. So please, you know, check this out. Check it out. That's what I would say. Check it out. Check it out. Is it possible to, to swim in the stream of meditative consciousness continuously? And then when you're checking that out and you find some difficulty, you don't actually, you still get distracted, you're very kind with yourself. You're very kind, and you say, I'm making my best effort. I'm making my best effort. And you're very kind with yourself, and you don't set up some expectation of perfect samadhi, you know. That's not realizing the way. That wouldn't be realizing the way, because the other, you know, the great compassionate side of the way is that, you know, Buddha cares for beings just as they are, and beings just as they are often very distracted, you know. That's just part of how it is, you know. We have many concerns. It's a wild and woolly world out there. And there's much to be concerned about, and we do get concerned about it. And it's hard to let go of it. So we're very, you know, at the same time that we might make this effort on our cushion, and we might listen to these wonderful teachings, these teachings of harmony, with the teaching of emptiness, with the teaching of returning to zero, returning to silence, returning to the stream of meditative consciousness. Wonderful teachings, and they're inspiring teachings, but we don't make them as a yardstick to which to compare ourselves to either. You know, we got to remember, don't make a yardstick to compare yourself to these descriptions. It's like an empty space. It's like a vast empty room. Oh, well, my mind isn't like that. Shoot. Well, guess what? My mind isn't like that either. And 40 years or more than that on, my mind is not like that. But I so much appreciate that teaching, and I so much have, you know, faith in that teaching. I have, and I would say I intend to continue my fidelity to that vision, you know, forever. That's my commitment, my fidelity to that vision. And that's faith, that's believing, that's what Suzuki Roshi is talking about. Continue to be faithful in that way, faithful to that vision for yourself and for other people too. For other people. Okay, I've carried on quite a bit. Do you want to say something? Does anyone want to ask a question? Yes?
I like your yardstick thing, and the first thing I thought of was, don't hit yourself with the yardstick.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't hit yourself with a yardstick.
Is that Rep's new book?
That book is not his newest book. That book is his second to the newest book. His newest book is on the paramitas. And it's called Buddha's Wisdom or something, I think.
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah, this is called the third... This book is called The Third Turning of the Wheel. It's a very difficult book, I will say that. It's a challenging book, one of the most challenging Dharma books I've ever run across. So just be forewarned if you want to look at it.
Something that you mentioned that rang with me, talking about staying in the stream, and you said something about if you fall in the eddies or what, be kind to yourself. And I remember some teacher making a point which I found extremely helpful, which is when you catch yourself as you were saying, I was meditating, because you're lost in something else, instead of chastising yourself, congratulate yourself for remembering to come back. And it's, you know, an encouragement that way. And it was very, I found it very helpful. So I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah.
When you're saying, be kind to yourself.
And you know, the key word you said there is remembering. And that is the definition of mindfulness, is that remembering. That's actually what the translation of the word, which is escaping me in Sanskrit right now, but the translation of the word for mindfulness is remembering, to remember yourself. Remember the teaching. Come back to the teaching, come back to yourself. Yeah. That's the definition of mindfulness. Yeah.
I find that when I realize I'm thinking a thought, the thought disappears, kind of evaporates back into the wherever it came from, kind of like a magic eight ball, you know, comes up out of the darkness, goes back into the darkness, some other random thing then pops up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, thoughts are ephemeral, right? We know this, right? And so you're seeing the ephemeralness of of your thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're seeing the
the clouds go through the sky.
Well, I was going to say all these terms that I used to know are starting to go away. Anicca, you know, impermanence. You're seeing Anicca, you know, the impermanence of your thinking, and that's one of the points, you know, of sitting meditation is to kind of have an effort to help the thoughts go poof, help if they're going poof anyway, you know, but you can send them on their way. Make sure you're not, you know, if when you see that there are just thoughts and you're not clinging to them. But there are thoughts, which there will be. Well, that's progress on the way, you know. They're just thoughts without a thinker, as someone said. Okay, well, if we carry on too much, we'll get off our schedule. So I think that's it. Thank you.